it's great to be back, and today I'll be talking about density matrix functional theory. Until recently, when I gave talks on this topic, I put a question mark at the end, but by now we are reasonably convinced that it's really a valid approach to these systems. So let's see if I convince you as well. I will start with the basic theorems on reduced density matrix functional theory. Then I'll discuss some approximate functionals. And then I'll show you results on molecules, the electron gas, metals, and insulators. And the particular focus in this last part will be on the calculation of the photoelectron spectrum within RDMFT. This was a big question mark, how to do this for many years, and I think we now found a way to calculate the density of states. Okay, what is the one-body density matrix? If you start from the many-body wave function, integrate out all particle coordinates but one, then you're left with this object, gamma of RNR prime. So that's the reduced, the so-called reduced one-body density matrix. And I'll ignore, just for the ease of notation, spin degrees of freedom here, but this can easily be extended to the spin case as well. So this is, if you have a pure state, if you have fractional particle number, and I'll come back to this, this is important in the context of the band gap, the density matrix looks like this. It's an ensemble density matrix. So the sum of two density matrices, each of those two referring to an integer particle number. Now, once you're given this object, gamma, you can diagonalize it, and the resulting orbitals are called natural orbitals. It's just a traditional name. And the occupation numbers, the eigenvalues, are called occupation numbers. So there is a central Hohenberg-Kohn type theorem since the 70s, was proven by Gilbert, that there's a rigorous one-to-one correspondence between the ground state one-body density matrix and the ground state many-body wave function. So once you know this, you can immediately write down the total energy as a function L of gamma, and using the Ritz variational principle, you can calculate the ground state energy of the system by minimizing this function L, keeping the external potential fixed. Now, this looks like the analogous expression in density functional theory, but the objects that we have here, in particular this exchange correlation functional, is actually quite different from the DFT case, and I'll discuss that in a minute. Now, a point that is important to note, we will then have to approximate this object here, and all the approximations that you're going to see throughout this talk will be explicit functionals of the occupation numbers and the natural orbitals. So just to keep in mind that this is also a functional of gamma, right? It's an implicit functional of gamma. It means, functional means, right, for this object, let's say, you give me a gamma and I tell you the number exe, right? So if I'm giving an approximate functional of that structure, depending on the orbitals and the occupation numbers, how do I calculate this number? Well, you give me gamma, then I diagonalize it, get the occupation numbers and the natural orbitals, and plug those in here and get the number. Right, so it's a function L of gamma.
Could I preempt Kieran by asking what is the domain of that function?
There's no problem with the domain, but I'll come back to this. We will have to include an N representability condition, which is very important. But otherwise, then those are just normalized, not even that orbitals, orthogonal. Wait a minute, I'll come back to this.
Okay. Like the footnote, which is, it hasn't yet taken a functional derivative. Once they take a derivative, that's when I ask the question. It's still very relevant. It's still very relevant.
Seems to be my lucky day, because I will never take a functional derivative. For good reasons.
For good reasons.
For good reasons, yes.
He knows where the controls are.
Okay, so we minimize this function now with a number of constraints. First of all, the sum of the occupation numbers should give the total number of electrons. That's one subsidiary condition. Then these natural orbitals should be orthonormal. And then, and this is a crucial point, the occupation numbers have to be between 0 and 1. So for fermionic systems, and that's a proof, not a trivial proof, there is this proof that shows that if and only if the occupation numbers lie between 0 and 1, then the function gamma of R and R prime comes from an n-body wave function. So that's what in the jargon of many-body theory is called n-representability. So this is important. So the first two conditions we can take into account with Lagrangian multipliers if we want. This one is cannot be cast into the form of a subsidiary condition that you can take into account with Lagrangian multipliers. One just has to take care of that directly somehow.
Yep. In the statement of Anderson's PhD, is there any statement about whether this many-body system, where the waveform comes from, is seeing a local potential or non-local potential?
I have not talked about potentials at all. I have not talked about V-representability.
Right, which means that this many-body wave function that you can cook up here, it could come from even a non-physical system.
It could.
Yeah. Or is it like an unlocal potential, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just draw your attention to the consequences of this n-representability condition. And this is the following. So, 2D example, our function here of the two occupation numbers, N1 and N2. And it means we need to minimize this given function L, or function in this case, with N1 and N2 restricted to this box here. Now, you see a case that can obviously happen, namely that the minimum is at the border. Right, you see this here, right? It's at the border. So the n-representability condition means that we can have minima which do not correspond to a horizontal tangent. This is something unusual in physics. Usually we minimize something, take a functional derivative and put it equal to zero. Right? Here we cannot do this. Okay, so let me now highlight a number of differences compared to DFT. At first sight, this looks like the total energy representation like in DFT, but there's three major differences. First of all, the kinetic energy, the exact interacting kinetic energy functional, we know it. It's this one. Right? If you give me the one-body density matrix, I can calculate from this expression, or this one, immediately the kinetic energy. So there's no approximations necessary for the kinetic energy functional. We know it.
Sorry, in the previous statement, you said you cannot do functional derivative. But that's not true, right? When
I come back to this.
When you do
Just wait two more slides.
All right.
Okay, so kinetic energy we know exactly. So in particular, we need not play this Cohn-Sham trick that we first treat the non-interacting kinetic energy exactly and then include the difference between the interacting and the non-interacting in the exchange correlation function. All this is not necessary here. It also means that there's no coupling constant representation of the exchange correlation energy. This coupling constant integral, which is the basis of all the Purdue crowd functionals. All this we don't do here. We don't have a coupling constant integration formula, or one could say we have one, but it's trivial, because this functional scales, this is an immediate consequence of the Coulomb interaction, scales linearly, like in DFT, only the exchange part. Okay, so that's one thing. Then, and now I'm coming back to Waiku's question, there is no variational equation of this kind. Why not? Well, if you think of an explicit approximate functional of orbitals and occupation numbers, then think of taking this derivative here, so you take it apart into a derivative with respect to the orbitals. This can be made zero, and the part with respect to the occupation numbers, but this, if the minimum is on the border, is not zero. So this expression that remains is generally not zero. So again, the statement that I made before, the minimum generally does not correspond to a horizontal tangent.
Proof of n representability, mm-hmm. Is that a sort of constructive proof in the sense that I give you a gamma that satisfies those conditions and construct a Slater term?
It's not constructive, no.
Well, not a Slater term, obviously, but it's not constructive. Okay.
It's not constructive, no.
So if I randomly give you one, you don't have a recipe for producing a function.
No.
I'm not saying it's hard.
That's hopeless, yeah. No. Yeah, you cannot. One could think of a constrained search like we have in DFT.
Yeah,
that is probably possible. Also not very useful, but it's...
No, I was thinking, yeah. Is there a simple...
No, certainly not in the proof. It's not constructive. Okay, yeah?
For this particular statement, you're right that this derivative doesn't exist because the functional...
No, the derivative exists, but it's not zero at the minimum.
Because this functional is the original function.
Yeah.
Of course, you can do a Lagrangian transformation, and you can define a new functional like Lagrangian where you change your variable, right? Like what Gilbert did. So instead of this, you define n being a cosine theta, and theta therefore is no longer bounded.
But this hides the problem. I mean, yes, it's true.
Right.
Yes.
So that's how Gilbert eventually proved it.
Yeah.
So you can find some approximate alternative function that do have a meaning.
Yes.
Right?
Surely the derivative doesn't exist on the domain as you described it, because of you have this hard condition on the occupation numbers.
Why should the derivative not exist? That's a different statement. I'm just saying it's not zero.
Yeah, I know, but then, I mean, usually when you have some sharp feature like that, then which way do you...
You don't have a sharp feature. It's perfectly fine, this red surface. It's just you have to be restricted to this.
You said your domain is restricted to these ones with...
Not the domain of the function now. The region in which I search for a solution. Okay. So, now, third point is there exists no Cohn-Sham system that reproduces the interacting one-body density matrix. That's obvious because if you assume there was one, then this Cohn-Sham system, being a non-interacting system, would have a density matrix that is idempotent, while the interacting density matrix is never idempotent. So you cannot possibly reproduce the density matrix of an interacting system with the density matrix of a non-interacting system.
Couldn't you have a Kunshan system, but you don't believe that it's the non-interacting system and it has occupation numbers that obey your restriction, so you partially occupy?
That may be true, but it's not a Kunshan system in the traditional sense.
Really non-interacting Kunshan system.
Yeah.
Maybe it's still naive, but for Gilbert, basically true that there is one Kunshan system, except that this Kunshan system has a Kunshan Hamiltonian where all the orbitals collapse at the same level, therefore they all degenerate. So it's a trivial, non-useful Kunshan system, but it does exist, right?
No, that's a misconception.
Why is that?
This is what happens if you do something similar as was suggested. If you think of a Kunshan system that yields only the orbitals, right? Is there a non-interacting system that yields the exact natural orbitals? You don't care about the occupation numbers. If you do something like this, then these you get an unphysical spectrum.
Yes, it's unphysical, but there is a Kunshan system, right?
No, there is obviously none. There is none, in that sense.
But what we call the system that the Gilbert derived using the functional derivative, that is non-interacting system. And the Eigenstate of this system is the mesh orbital, right? The only thing that you don't like is that it has a very strange spectrum, that all the eigenvalues are the same.
It is not a Kunshan system in the sense that the density matrix of that Kunshan system reproduces the density matrix of the interacting system. No, it doesn't. It cannot possibly exist.
Because if they all degenerate, the occupation number is no longer 0 or 1, it's fractional. And that's how you generate. That's the only way out, right? If you have all orbital collapsing to the same level, the occupation number are 3, then they can reproduce the exact thing about density matrix, because they are no longer 1 or 0. If the model is only described, if they don't have degeneracy, then it's 1 or 0. But if they all exact in the chemical potential, you don't have a problem.
Well, you still have a problem, because this Kunshan Hamiltonian is essentially it's a delta function. So well, it's all highly. we thought about this for years.
Now, Oleg Pankratov claimed to have a way around that.
Yeah, that's at finite temperature. Right?
At finite temperature, so I see.
Finite temperature. You don't have this statement, right? And then you could construct one. But as you lower the temperature, you still run into this problem that the whole spectrum collapses to one number.
Actually, he can also do it with low temperature. What he does is that he moves away from the equilibrium station point a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And there's tricks that people have done. Sure. Okay. As such, this is a firm statement. Okay, now approximate functionals. The first one is not approximate, that's just a Hartree term that we always have. And then there's a famous functional that was invented by Müller in 1984, was subsequently forgotten, was not perceived by the community. But it's really a stroke of genius. So have a look at this. This is essentially an exchange expression. But there is this prefactor with the square root of the occupation numbers. And this is the complete exchange correlation energy. It's not just exchange or so, it's the complete functional. And was afterwards re-derived in several ways independently by other people, not knowing that it existed already. So Müller's derivation is, I call it minimizing the disaster. He makes a certain ansatz for the two-body density matrix, uses a number of exact features of the two-body density matrix, for example, that it reduces if you integrate to the one-body density matrix, and a few other scaling and normalization conditions, and then ends up with this in the following way. He calculates the pair probability density and finds out it can get negative with this particular ansatz. And he then optimizes a parameter that is in this ansatz such that it's as little negative as possible. So he minimizes this disaster, the probability can become negative, and then he ends up with this in Ni Nj to the 1/2.
You're standing in front of some graph.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was hoping to see.
Okay. This is from these German Wilhelm Busch tales. This is the Müller. Right. So since the name of this person is Müller.
And you're telling us that the intentions of this guy are good.
Well, let's see. So, until today, basically, all the functionals available are variations of the Müller functional. There's essentially nothing else. So one variation was developed by Göriger and Umrigar. So this is Müller, by taking out the self-interaction terms. The self terms, J equal K, are removed from these sums here and there. And I will show you results in a minute. Then one functional that was our idea is to replace this square root by a power alpha. And the idea is kind of a modern one in DFT. It in a sense corresponds to a mixing scheme because the limit alpha equal 1 corresponds to Hartree-Fock. And alpha equal 1/2, which is the Müller functional, actually one can see it over correlates. So this alpha kind of between 1/2 and 1 is kind of a mixing parameter. I'll show you some results on this in a minute. It's actually not exactly trivial to show that alpha equal 1 corresponds to Hartree-Fock. Right? It's not a Hartree-Fock functional, because in Hartree-Fock there are no occupation numbers, but if you write here just nj times nk, so alpha equal 1, then you can prove that the minimum of that functional is the same as the Hartree-Fock energy. That was not a trivial proof, actually.
What happened to j equals k now, just in the formula? Just because just added on the
J equal K?
J not equal K or J equal K?
Well, you can either do it in the Göriger Omega prescription, take it out, or leave it in.
Just specified.
Yeah, that is both ways. Okay, and then there's another group of functionals, so-called BBC functionals, meaning Boyse Barons corrected. And there you change the sign. So the key idea there is to distinguish between strongly and weakly occupied orbitals. Strongly occupied ones is where the occupation number is close to 1, and weakly occupied ones is where the occupation number is close to 0. And then depending on whether it's weakly or strongly correlated, you can change the sign, like in this one, of the square root. And there's good reasons for this. In fact, there's one case where you know the exact functional. That's for two electrons with opposite spin. This is an old work by Levdin. And to make this Müller functional closer to the Levdin result, then this change of sign is necessary. Okay, then there's another prescription, BBC2, where if both I and J are strongly occupied, then you just don't use the square root. This is to make for such orbitals to keep the full exchange. Okay. Yeah, of course there's some ambiguity exactly in the interesting cases. Namely, the interesting cases are the strongly correlated ones where they're close to 1/2. Right.
The weakly occupied just means that Ni and Nj are small.
Yeah, close to zero. Yeah.
So doesn't that introduce discontinuities in the functional? As N, I, and J change?
In principle, yes, but you find that for most systems, actually, the occupation numbers are in fact very close to one or very close to zero. So then it actually doesn't. But
this is somehow related to the discontinuity and the training potential, right?
I come back to that. Okay, so this is the functionals available. I just wanted to mention those. And now I'm going the chemist's procedure. Since you're a chemist, I'm going to show you results.
The old work with the two electron case, what does that look like? You said by making that square root a minus, it looks more like.
Yeah.
I mean, can you say in.
No.
25 words or less?
No.
It looks like.
No. I mean, it's not a simple expression.
Right. And there isn't a way
to look at the formula. It's not. No, I don't think there is a simple way. Just make it mathematically closer in that limit of two electrons. Okay, so we did calculations first for finite systems in the chemist's way. So we used the G2 set. And here's the result. Oops. So the way this is plotted is we did more or less exact reference calculations, that is coupled clusters, single, double, triples, perturbatively, versus the correlation energy calculated with these RDMFT functionals. So the perfect result would be this line. Right, that would be perfect agreement. And yeah, this is what you get. So one of the BBC functionals here turns out best. Then, yeah?
What would be the exchange part? Are they exact?
Or? Yeah.
So this is the version with the self-interaction correction or not?
What we do is we plot the correlation energy here, because that's in a sense the most interesting part. Right? But you're right, one could also plot the full exchange correlation.
Because the function that you show us is actually EXC, right?
Yes, you're right, yes. It's more revealing to look at the small quantity, right, which is the correlation energy. That's why we do it here. But one could do that as well, yeah, certainly. So Gödiger Umegar is without self-energy, BBC3 and Müller are including self-interaction terms.
Well, usually in chemistry, right, they have a slightly bigger basis set, and they would look at correlation energy differences.
Right? Yeah, I know that chemists like energy differences. But, well, I would claim the correlation energy is, after all, an important quantity. In the end, this is what you would like to get right. Oh yes, it's necessary. I mean, there's other people but chemists in the world that are interested maybe in other numbers. Right. Total energies are measurable, after all. They're maybe not interesting for chemists, but total energies is a measurable quantity, right? And people have measured them. So this is a measurable quantity, right? But as chemists you don't have to care. No, but the real point is not that. I would claim that ultimately, maybe in 20 years or later, you will probably treat exchange exactly everywhere, not range separated and all that stuff. And well, then this object is what you really want to get right in the end. But that's a personal opinion.
Could you explain how you actually implement this procedure? You minimize by the orbitals and the occupation numbers?
Yes, yes. Okay, I didn't say that, sorry. So what we do is we expand the natural orbitals in Hartree-Fock orbitals, and then we minimize the total energy just by some of the minimization algorithms that you have. With respect to the occupation numbers and the expansion coefficients of the orbitals.
So what happened to the boundary of the occupation?
Okay, good point. So whenever we see, that's the simplest procedure, whenever we see that an occupation number wants to become larger than one, then we put it back to one. Very simple. And it happens all the time, in fact, because the roughly speaking, the bosonic solution is always lower energy. So you always want to occupy these low-lying orbitals with more than one particle.
In principle, you can do exactly the same procedure, but now using the, say, the Gilbert function, using the cosine theta, using the theta as a variable as opposed to n. Then you wouldn't have to worry about one, just try to truly.
Well, you get then as a variational equation an equation that essentially tells you that you have to avoid this going out of this domain. It just hides the problem.
You really have a domain that is unbounded, right?
Yeah.
You just say.
No, I understand what you mean, but it doesn't change anything.
You get the same answer.
Yeah.
Of course.
Could you just summarize the message that we should take from this graph? I mean, are the red results regarded as already very good quality?
Yeah, that comes within next transparencies. So, I think not. Here, you tell yourself. Are there any open shells there? I think the G2 set has no open shells. Well, this is it. You are the chemist, you must know.
There are single radicals there.
Yes.
So they really have exact total correlation energy, not so for this set. I thought maybe it's very hard also for them to really converge the total energy.
Well, the total energy, yeah. You have that too, yes. But I'm plotting here the smallest part of the total energy, which is the correlation, because that's most revealing. Total energy.
You find this local minimum. So do you have a lot of local minimum in the minimization?
Well, of course, whenever you do a minimization of a function that has many variables, you can never be 100% sure that you end up in a side minimum. But we hope we don't.
If it's a closed shell, then you should have some
important.
If it's open shell, then it's more likely. What if you did not get any?
Just out of curiosity, what is a good algorithm to minimize all these variables?
Conjugate gradients. Yeah. That's what we use.
The calculation then is a lot like a Hartree-Fock calculation. It doesn't take much more time than Hartree-Fock.
Yeah, so that's an important question. So it's not like a Hartree-Fock calculation in the sense that we don't solve any eigenvalue equation, because there is no eigenvalue equation, just minimize. But the numerical effort is roughly Hartree-Fock-like, because the main thing is to set up the Fock matrix in that basis, and that's exactly what we are doing here as well. A bit more, because you involve also the unoccupied states, but roughly it's Hartree-Fock effort. Okay, so this is now the...
I have a question about if one do some kind of hybrid functional calculation, what kind of point does work on this plot?
Well, that's the next transparency. Good point. So those are the three best functionals so far. The alpha function, the BBC3 that I mentioned, and yet another one that is a bit different. P stands for Pieris, the main author. So they are roughly the same quality, these three. Okay, this is the same thing. This is energy differences from the exact number. That's those three are the best, so that's the lowest error. It's almost as good as MP2, all for the G2 set. Well, this is what you see from this.
I mean, if I understand correctly, it's of the order of 2 or 3 electron volts apparent, typically. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that better than
total correlation energy? That is the next transparency. Yeah, that is this one. Okay, so this is now a comparison of one of these three that are roughly the same, BBC3 in red, with Müller-Placid, and with the workhorse of chemistry, the B3 Lipp functional, which is the first hybrid. Yeah, have a look. What a disaster, B3 Lipp. Of course, it's an unfair comparison in the sense that chemists only care about energy differences, and there it looks much better. But still, it's pretty bad.
I thought it's a different correlation functional because the correlation doesn't contain a kinetic contribution.
No, it's all looking at the same quantity. So that's the quantum chemical definition of correlation energy is total energy minus Hartree-Fock bar.
Doesn't this set bear any relation to the test set on which it was originally optimized?
Okay. If you look at a different set, then it may look different, sure. This,
yeah. No, I'm just surprised that Q3 is set.
Well, they optimized with respect to different things. Energy differences, right? That is the relevant thing.
So let me clarify this.
That's nice.
In order to do energy differences, you have to do things like atoms, which are open shell, very open shell. I mean, you can think of almost any system in terms of energy differences. You can make huge errors. Many of the functionals do in the total energy, but as long as those errors cancel, you get energy differences. Good, even total energy of a system, sequence of ionization energies, right? But then you have to go through all the various open shells as you do that. So if, and when you say the G2 data set, right, you're talking about the molecules in the G2 data set, not the actual numbers, because those are differences in that sense, right? You can look at differences in,
what do you mean? Numbers. We have the G2 set of molecules.
Yes. That's very different.
And on that set, that's a different story.
Yeah.
The G2 set of molecules, and on those molecules, we calculate the correlation energy. That's what we're doing. And I would claim it's an important quantity, but one may argue about this.
Well, you have to know when this is characteristic of PFT, or if you, for instance, use one of Trump's meta-GDAs, then I think it's certainly better.
Not much.
Probably same. Probably similar.
Yeah. But even if you do CI singles and doubles in a decent-sized basis set, it won't do particularly well because it's the total energy converges much more slowly than these energy differences.
Yeah, of course. That's why chemists get away. That's why one gets away, if one is interested in energy differences only, with the usual quantum chemistry methods. That's true. If one is interested in something else, one has a problem.
I also want to ask about MP2, because I'm looking at, just by eye, looking at this, the blue points seem much closer to the straight line than the red points,
yeah.
Whereas on your previous graph, you said it was almost as good as...
Well, not quite.
Yeah. Yes.
That's a bit better. That's about the same. If you average over, then it's...
Somehow the MP2 not quite on the line, but they're almost the same displacement from the line, whereas the red points are much more scattered.
Yes, that's right. That's, I guess, it's because MP2 is variational. Should always be above, and the others are not. Is that true?
MP2 is not variational.
Not variational. Is it simple? No, it's not. Forget it. Yeah.
And are all these with that basis set?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. MP2, of course, has a very low order diagram, right? Which means that in terms of correlation,
it's
limited in order.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that you show this very good agreement is how it relates to the fact that this particular set of cold shell systems are not strongly correlated.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So in a sense, what I showed so far is all not very interesting. I mean, it's equilibrium distance of weakly correlated systems. So that's not really the focus of my interest, which I will now come to.
Let me ask you one more question. If one were thinking about the miracle of LDA or these regimes, for example, it's probably that when they go to strongly correlated systems, they wouldn't do that bad either, right? Here they do that not so well. If you go to strongly correlated systems, maybe they are not doing too bad either. Well, maybe two might start to fail.
What do you mean, doing not too bad either?
Well, they're not order by order perturbation, right? So they have this miracle of cancellation of error and so on. So it's not clear that...
No, when I mean strongly correlated systems, as I will define in a minute, I really mean systems where LDA does not work at all, right? So zero disaster. Yeah. And this is one example, stretched H2. Right? So, as you all know, in Hartree-Fock or any kind of Cohn-Sham calculation, independent of the functional, as long as you insist that you have a spin singlet, then this is what you get typically, right? So this is the Hartree-Fock curve, right? And LDA, and they all look very similar. So completely wrong limit. This is CI, and one of the best, again, this BBC3, is right on top. Right. The other, Müller and Gödicke Omega, are a bit worse. But stretched H2, which is the chemist's paradigm of a strongly correlated system, can be treated with density matrix functional theory, and the reason is simple. If you think of what is the problem with Hartree-Fock and Cohn-Sham, why don't you get it? Well, if you think of the equilibrium distance, the bonding and the antibonding orbitals, one is important in a CI expansion, 95% or so, and the antibonding one is very little contribution. Well, as you stretch it, then those two orbitals, the bonding and the antibonding orbitals, become degenerate. And they are equally important, but if you do Hartree-Fock or Cohn-Sham in a singlet situation, you just have the bonding one, right? So the antibonding one is unoccupied, no matter how far out you go. So you have to get this back through the functional, right? You have to have a functional that includes also unoccupied orbitals, and with that you kind of can get it. Well, here it's totally natural that you get it. As you stretch it, the occupation numbers become 50-50, and that's it. That's this plot. This is not our work. This was first demonstrated by the authors of BBC, where you get this nice result that convinced me that it's worthwhile looking into strongly correlated solids, because this is a bit like a Mott insulator, right? Hydrogen chain.
Is it in some sense to be expected because the physics of what happens at H2 at large distances was one of the considerations that they built into the formulation of BBC3, or is it a more remarkable agreement?
I think is for the specific case of BBC3, it's one could argue they kind of built it in the functional. One could argue, but it's other functionals you get it quite well as well with this alpha functional, for example. I don't have the numbers here, but I think the deeper reason is really that as you stretch you get 50-50, which is something that you can never get in DFT.
Thank you.
So are you saying that the BDC 3 gives you the exact limit? It does give you the exact limit.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's built in.
So isn't that also true for the Miller and the Cheese?
No. They don't go to the exact limit, no.
Ah, yes, I meant in terms of the form of the wave function. No. I'm sorry, I thought that's what you meant was good about the BBC3.
No, in the particular form of the function of BBC3, one could argue that the way they choose it is tailored to be able to describe this kind of thing. While for the others, that's not the case. I mean, the square root that you get with Müller has nothing to do with this specific case.
But do the occupation numbers become 50-50?
Yes.
Or yeah. Even the other functions?
Yeah, also. Yeah.
So they will be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another way, I guess the other way to say what you said, why this works so well, is related to the Feller-Wolnick-Kahn-Schoenberg system. We are confined to a single determinant and the occupation of such a single determinant.
Yeah.
Here you actually have some kind of ensemble built into the system.
Yeah.
That system allows you to single it in other kind of treatment and so on. Mm-hmm.
That's another way of saying it. Yes. Yeah. I agree.
Is there any way to apply the exact result for the two electron case more generally?
I think that is this BBC2 functional in a way.
Well, it's an approximation to that.
Yeah.
But can people?
No, because it just involves the two orbitals. So it's kind of. Not good. Okay, so these functionals that I showed so far were all kind of deduced or derived with a view on finite systems, and we just blindly applied them to the uniform gas to see what comes out. So the total energy, total correlation energy compared to the Seppeli-Alder result is not particularly convincing. This is the Müller curve. The other ones is BBC1 and BBC2 cross the exact line here. So this is better. But what I find most remarkable is this. Namely, it's a feature of the momentum distribution that has this, for interacting systems, that has this vertical jump. And the size of that jump is the order parameter of the Fermi liquid. The bigger it is, the less, the more Fermi liquid-like is the system. And these functionals that were designed for molecules, really, they give a jump here. It's really a vertical jump, amazingly.
That's vertical for about a jump of about 35%, and then on the low energy side, it looks as if it has a discontinuous slope up there.
Yeah, no, this is. One would need a finer mesh to see that it's not discontinuous. It's not discontinuous.
Is the exact form of this momentum distribution known at RS equals 1?
I don't think there is a formula.
So, but this 35% discontinuity is. There are estimates of that, and I presume that you're saying that that's a good. Agrees well with
what you do know is the size, so it's usually called Z, as a function of RS. So that function is known.
From QMC, right?
From QMC, from many body theory, there's various theories.
And for approximation equal to 1, you should have something like 0.9, right? Z factor.
Yeah.
So
the value that you get with DMFT is not good. in particular, the behavior as a function of RS is not right with these functionals.
Oh, but it's constant RS, it doesn't shrink as you increase RS?
It stays more or less constant. So you don't get the right behavior for this, let's call it molecular functionals, but okay.
Well, hold on, but I mean, if you defined it slightly differently, right? If you defined it as the drop in the momentum distribution from a little bit before one to a little bit after one,
yeah.
It's almost fine.
Okay, yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's a question of your choice of definition.
You cannot do this for solid, because everything in solid happens by chemical potential.
Well, it's temperature uniform gas.
Well, one could play with this. That's not the point, really. Yeah, sure.
The occupation drops precipitously.
Drops rapidly.
The fact that it isn't quite on the, right in the limit doesn't matter.
Any physicist will tell you no. It cannot be. It's so important.
Kieran, what you're saying is that the high energy tail looks good to you. That's all you're saying.
No, I'm saying.
No, the drop. He's talking about
the drop. Of course, it's a molecular based functional, and so it doesn't get the analytic properties correct. But the fact, the physical fact is that it drops precipitously around Fermi, and that's. Yeah.
No, that's not remarkable. I mean, that's also true in Cohen-Chung. It's just that the drop is equal to 1.
Yes.
The only good thing I could see.
We shouldn't be looking at RS equals 1. We should be looking at 6.
Yeah, the only good thing I could see in that was that the high energy tail is nicely falling to 0. But I mean, that's what you'd expect on the basis of any sort of mixing of configuration. And the low energy performance was most peculiar, as it was Phil pointed out. With this kink and a sloping fire.
Yeah, but to be honest, right, this kind of jump, any perturbation theory much better than
these, like GW, whatever. Yeah. No, all I'm saying is here you can hardly avoid having a jump, even with these functionals, and if you work on the functionals more, I'm sure you get the right answer. And that can be done. Okay, now the gap. We proceed to the more critical issues. So just to remind you, the proper definition of the total energy, if you have fractional particle number, is the low temperature limit of a grand canonical ensemble. So we end up with an expression for this, where M is now a fractional number, and there's a conjecture by Elliott Leap that for Coulomb systems, this curve, N being integers, is upward convex. To the best of my knowledge, has not been proven yet, but it's a conjecture. One never found a counterexample. And if this is true, one can prove within a few lines that this general expression reduces to this one. That's more or less trivial. Which tells you the well-known fact that total energy is a sequence of straight lines. So here it is. And total energy. Sequence of straight lines. Then ionization potential is the energy to remove an electron. Electron affinity is the energy that you need to add an electron. And the difference between the two is the definition of the fundamental gap. I will use this expression also for finite systems. But for finite systems, it's usually called the chemical hardness, but it's the same object, I minus A. Okay, now you see immediately, here's the curve that we had before. This difference is the ionization potential. This difference here is the electron affinity. And if you now remember that the chemical potential is the derivative of this curve, then you get, and since it's straight lines, you get one number here for that slope, another number, in general, another number for that slope. So you get discontinuity of the chemical potential. So the value of the chemical potential, if you are between n minus 1 and n, is the ionization potential, and in this interval, the value is electron affinity. And since the difference between the two is the gap, you can also write the gap as the difference of chemical potentials, this value that you have on this side of the integer minus the one on the other side. Okay, and this is one way of calculating the gap within density matrix functional theory. This is just a reminder, so this formula that I showed you before in DFT leads to this. And this is now a plot of the chemical potential as a function of particle number. This is for the lithium hydride molecule. So there's, first of all, you see something like a jump here, right? Clearly, there is something like a discontinuity, but it's not really what you like. So you, first of all, you would like a horizontal behavior here, which you don't have. This is not really discontinuous, it's more like round. And also, the jump here is not exactly at the integer. So there's a few deficiencies here, which are due to the fact that we use an approximate functional. This is the BBC2 or BBC3. But, I mean, if you kind of put a slope here and then take this as the location of the lower discontinuity, you can kind of estimate the value of the jump here by this kind of tangent construction. And you can compare with experiment or CI calculations. And you see it's actually quite close.
Is there a difference between experiment and CI?
Well, you can drive CI further, I'm sure. Yes, this depends on how much work you want to invest. So here's a few numbers. So, quite close. And now the real challenge. So, strongly correlated solids. So, what do I call a strongly correlated solid? Of course, there's many ways of defining that. For metals, it's easy. It's the value of that jump, right? The smaller it is, the more highly correlated the metal. If you have insulators, it's not so easy, right? You have all these concepts of band insulator, charge transfer insulator, Mott insulator. All these words come from different areas of physics, and you... what is a strongly correlated case? Well, here comes my definition. If you imagine what a true Mott insulator is, I would define it as one that stays insulating as you heat it up above the nail temperature. So as you know, at zero temperature, those are antiferromagnetic insulators. But as you go up above the nail temperature, a true Mott insulator stays insulating. That's my definition. Now, this reflects the fact that Mott physics has to do with charge localization. It has nothing to do with spin. Now, if you imagine doing a finite temperature DFT, finite temperature Kohn-Sham calculation, let's say for the prototype of such a system, which is a 1D chain of hydrogen atoms, right, independent of the functional that you use, will always have a half-filled band, right? One electron per proton, always have a half-filled band. So you always have a metal. You cannot possibly avoid getting a metal above the nail temperature where you have no magnetism. That's an important point. So at zero temperature, you can play this Slater trick, it's sometimes called. You double the unit cell, have this antiferromagnetic order, and half the Brillouin zone. So in this way, you can get it insulating. And this is what people have called Slater insulator. They have the feature that as you heat them up above the nail temperature, they become metallic at the nail temperature. And such systems exist in nature, right? But a true Mott insulator is one that stays insulating. Now that's my definition. And this means also that this is a kind of system that you cannot possibly describe reasonably with Kornsham, right? This is what I just said. Whatever functional you use, even the exact functional, will give you a half-filled band. So it is the group of systems that I would call truly strongly correlated, where the Kornsham gap is zero, so the Kornsham system is metallic, while the true system is an insulator. Now, formally, this is not a problem for DFT, right? The Kornsham system is just supposed to reproduce the density of the interacting system, so formally there's no problem with that. But, of course, in practice, it's a horrible thing if you want to describe an insulator by a Kornsham system that is metallic. If you want to do anything else with it, many-body theory or whatever, it's not a good idea. So this is the kind of thing that we took as a challenge. And now, with our tangent construction, we calculated the gaps of looking at the discontinuity of the chemical potential at the gaps of these systems here. And this is what you get. The red dots are the RDMFT calculations. So what is plotted here is the relative difference from the experimental numbers. And the blue lines here are GW calculations, so the spread indicates the values that you find in the literature. So for those weakly correlated systems, you're about as good or as bad as GW, I would say, while here for the truly strongly correlated systems, you get a gap, while in GW you don't. For nickel oxide, you do get a gap in GW, but I would claim this is a spin effect, and if you do a GW calculation without spin, you also don't get it, I think. All right, this is another thing. This is ultimately also an experimentally accessible result. This is the difference between the LDA charge density and the charge density calculated using density matrix functional theory. And in density matrix functional theory, here this is cobalt oxide, we find a stronger charge localization than in the competing methods, for example, LDA plus U. Let's see, this should be measurable with positron annihilation. So let's see who's right. Okay, now the last part, and this kept us busy for maybe 5 years, because ultimately you don't just want the gap. Right, you also want the band structure, the density of states, let's say. How can you calculate the band structure within RDMFT? And that's difficult. Right? You don't have a single particle-like equation, no Kornsham equation, so no spectrum. If you play this trick of Gilbert, your spectrum collapses to one number, which is also not useful. So how can you define it? And this is not a proof, what I'm going to show you. This is a plausibility argument. So let me tell you what we do. We kind of try to mimic photoemission direct or inverse experiment. So, in other words, we remove or add an electron with a well-defined momentum. And this is what you do in the experiment, ultimately. Not necessarily in the first Brillouin zone. And clearly the electron addition or removal energy is defined by this, right? So this is the proper definition of a quasi-particle spectrum. This is what we all agree on. This is what is in the denominator of the Green's function, right? Okay, so this is a good point. Ground state is maybe not a good number. It's a constrained total energy where one has added a particle with momentum k. So it's a constrained ground state, so to say. It's not really the ground state, so it's not, I should have dropped that. Yeah, that's a good point.
What I mean is that when we remove or add a particle of momentum k, the quasi-particle spectrum for all the possible states.
Yeah, we too. This is because k is not in the first Brillouin zone. So that corresponds to it if you fold it outwards. Yeah, that's equivalent. Yeah. But it's not, strictly speaking, a ground state in that sense. So even if you remember electron gas, right, the parabola, and right, then this is the first Brillouin zone, then you can fold this back and so on, right? You see that these k values that are outside the first Brillouin zone correspond to these higher lying states. But it's a restricted ground state where you add or subtract a particle with momentum k. K is given.
It's important. It's not crystal momentum. It's the real momentum.
No, it's the crystal momentum in the end.
Crystal momentum.
Yeah. Because this is what you also measure. I mean, you measure the kinetic energy of the either outcoming photon or outcoming electron. That is, and you conclude that this is then corresponding to the what you have in the crystal. Right?
So hopefully k is the total crystal momentum of the many body state, and you allow the other electrons, as it were, to adjust themselves to the,
yes,
the, mm-hmm, the additive.
You are using this mimic the excited signal of n plus 1 and n minus 1.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think so far there is not really a discussion, right? This is more or less the experiment. The critical point comes now. Namely, we approximate this quantity, which we really should get exactly the way as you said, right? We add this momentum, this particle with momentum k, and then relax everything else. This is what one should do, but we don't do that. What we do is this. We take this energy difference, where this is defined in the following way. We have this total energy functional as a functional of all occupation numbers and all natural orbitals. Right? And we keep all the phis and all the occupation numbers except that one nk. You keep all those fixed to the relaxed ground state values. And then we just simply evaluate this function as a function of nk. So why is this, let's say, this is not a proof, right? I should emphasize that. I'm not trying to prove here that this is right. I'm just trying to say it's not unplausible to do that. And the argument is kind of, well, if you add one electron to an extended system, it shouldn't really change much the other orbitals and the other occupation numbers. So that's our rationale of keeping those fixed to the all those except the one, the nk, fixed to the relaxed ground state ones.
But that argument comes from the weakly correlated world, which is precisely the world in which you came not to be. If you have localized electrons, that argument doesn't work.
Even then, if this electron is localized, I still would claim the others don't change much.
what happened to screaming in that verbal formulation?
Don't know. It's not a term that we would easily see here.
It's a definition not too strongly coded in the sense that if you have an energy catastrophe, right, and a particle goes to a different state, this definitely will never work. Right?
Yeah. But then before
even the equation that invites epsilon k in energy difference, that already assumes the existence of quasi particles, right? You have one energy per k out of this formula. Right?
No. This means you actually identify these natural objects as quasi particles.
No, I'm not saying that.
But you are changing the occupation number of n case in one particular natural object.
Yeah, but I just look at the total energy, how the total energy changes. When I add or subtract a particle with momentum k, I'm not really saying that this orbital is the orbital in which nature should. I'm not saying it's the quasi particle orbital, I'm not doing that. No.
So you have this movement theorem. If we assume that this particle orbital is not relaxed, then this corresponds to this photo emission process. But here, these natural orbitals do not have that kind of physical meaning, even within the assumption that they do not relax.
And the conjecture is that this total energy for a given k can be evaluated in this way.
But I think what is k? K is always kind of attached to some orbital.
Yes. But all the orbitals here are kept fixed to the ground state values. So it's, I mean, there's two empirical results entering here that we found out over the years, that actually the total energy doesn't change much when you change orbitals, but it changes a lot when you change the occupation numbers. That's one thing, so the occupation numbers is really the important thing. The other, aspect is that if you plot this object here, I'm going to show you one on the next transparency, that it's almost linear. And it's some curvature, but it's almost linear. By any system, by any NK, interestingly. This is an empirical finding. I'm not saying there's a proof or anything.
But I think it might be exact.
It might. If you have a proof, I'd be very happy to see it.
I think the system as it gets bigger, I mean, none of the orbitals are even what we call localized orbitals. They're not.
No, one can. No. That's an important fact that we have used. One can prove that for a periodic solid, the natural orbitals are Bloch states. So they have well-defined k.
And you're adding one particle.
Yeah. If that particle has a k, a well-defined k, it has to be that block of that k. Yeah,
I think in the term of the
one may be able to prove something.
So for astronomy critical system, you want to describe, because there you have this so-called lower upper half of the band. There you cannot characterize this band by k vector, so the k is not really a good quantum number. For this so-called lower upper half.
Well,
it's called incoherent band. So
no.
So you cannot really use band structures.
This remark that you're making comes from the Hubbard world.
Yeah.
That's
the one.
And this is not. The gap is what I wrote down. It's the ionization potential minus the electron affinity for any system. Right. This is general too. That is the definition of it. Right? And in fact, for the system that you're describing, also within the Hubbard model, it becomes the U, yes. These bands become the upper and lower Hubbard bands. But it's still electron affinity minus ionization potential. That's the number.
But there's no key. So you want to use this key to for this grammar gathering.
Okay, now one technical detail at the very end. So how do you best calculate such an energy difference? Well, where we use the trick that was already used by Slater in the Slater transition state, it's the same idea. If you want to calculate such an energy difference, if you do it the stupid way, you expand around the value zero, it's delta n then is equal one. The difference then is just the slope at zero plus corrections of delta n squared. Well, if you do it the clever way, you expand around n equal 1 half. So at 1, you get this. At 0, you get this. But delta n is minus 1 half, delta n plus 1 half here. And then the difference, you immediately see, zero order terms cancel out, second order terms cancel out. And what remains, remember this is plus 1 half, this is minus 1 half. The difference gives you e prime evaluated at the midpoint. So it's sometimes called the midpoint rule. And so this is then the way we ultimately calculate the spectrum. But this is just a numerical detail. One could also take these total energy differences, but this is especially in view of the fact that this function is almost linear, that should be an extremely good approximation. Okay, now results. This is for metals, the density of states for vanadium, copper, and this is an insulator, a weakly correlated insulator, cubic boron nitride. And we compare here RDMFD with GW, LVA, yellow, and experiment. So this gray thing is the experiment. The red is RDMFD. So there are differences between these methods.
Sorry, what experiment is this?
That is
photo emission.
Photo emission, yeah.
It's is that a really high quality, believable experiment?
Probably not.
It's pretty good.
Probably not. Well, that's all we could find for this instance.
I really have to do
there has to be a better experiment.
Well, angle resolve would give very different picture, but but this is integrated the angle resolved, so in principle it should be better.
Yeah, well, this is what we found. If you have a better experiment, tell me. Look at the references.
Sorry, Miss, is this angle resolved? The calculations and angle resolved, so. Is this total?
This is total here, the picture, but could be made angle resolved. Okay, so this is, one clearly would need a better experiment to design. So this is not very conclusive, this picture. So the interesting, the gap here is roughly the same as the experiment in RDMFT. But okay, that's not so interesting. Now, this is the final one, almost final transparency. So this is now strongly correlated systems, nickel oxide, iron oxide, cobalt oxide, manganese oxide. And we compare to the competitors, DMFD and GW. So the gray part is the experiment. So for these systems, there's good experiments available, except iron oxide. Iron oxide kind of doesn't exist. It exists experimentally only in segregated form. So this is, it's just to compare the methods among each other. But here, nickel oxide, this is the DMFT and GW result, the red. is the RDMFT result. This looks pretty good. Cobalt oxide were an LDA, and don't plot LDA here, you don't even get a gap. Again, it's kind of similar, right? The DW comes here and the cobalt oxide. But again, DW only in the in the presence of spin order, while so one could argue you get the gap for the wrong reason. While our calculations are without any spin order. And here, manganese oxide as well. Quite close to experiment. Details differ, but I would say pretty close to experiment.
Why does the RDMFT tend to have these violent oscillations?
I don't know. Maybe they are real.
The GW, I don't know how it's done, but in principle, the GW can have the broadening of the quasi-particle, which certainly improves the comparison with experiment. If it's in those curves or not, I don't know. But the RDMFT, you have no theory for the broadening, so you're going to get a sharper spectrum than experiment.
Yeah, in that sense, yes. Yeah. So we have certain, well, maybe there's a way of getting complex numbers as well, but we haven't thought about that. Yeah, and that's a good point.
This is, of course, a very interesting text, but I can tell you that it's going to fail quite miserably if you now take one of these insulator, dope it with small amount of doping. Immediately you see that anything related to this quasi-particle picture, which is your formula is using. I think that intrinsically the RDMFT has no problem. But the way the quasi-particle spectrum is evaluated, the formula they use is based on the assumption that there is quasi-particle. Mm-hmm. And that assumption is going to break down entirely when you go to a dogma insulator, when you dope, say, introduce the first hole or second hole you introduce in the system, immediately you get into the same problem that all the mean field like theory has, that your chemical potential will collapse to the edge and bend, and you start to populate below or above bend. Well, in the really cold system, you're going to generate a lower upper band with a way sharp hole, with some kind of maybe even appearance of a condo-like key. That will never happen with any theory that doesn't have omega dependence. So the way
this argument comes from the DMFT world. You cannot argue.
This is more reason.
You do get a condo peak. You check this thing. You cannot argue that in this theory there is no frequency and therefore you cannot get it. This argument comes from the DMFT world.
No, but if you go back to the formula you use, you assume there is a quasi particle. Because you, for every k, you have one energy.
I'm mimicking the experiment.
Yeah, but
every particle with momentum k, that's all.
Yeah, but every k, you have only one epsilon k. That is the assumption of quasi particle. In the real universe, that assumption doesn't exist. Every k, you're supposed to sum over all the spectral correspond to that k, not just the ground state energy of that k.
I'm talking about ground state, really.
But I'm saying that if you look at the linear representation rigorously, right? Mm-hmm. Every k that you have actually a continuous spectrum of energy that you need to sum over. But the formula you use only gives you one epsilon k. And that is intrinsically a limitation of the particle picture.
Lehmann representation is misleading. I wouldn't really refer to that.
No, you can rigorously rewrite the representation using your basis, by right? Using schemolytic k basis. You will find that the formula is not the same as the one you wrote.
No, I'm using quasi-particle representation.
Right. That's correct.
In that sense, yes. That's true.
But there is a thing, which is when you dope it, right, then everything can rearrange because of this dependence on the natural orbitals. Right? The entire representation can change. you don't, you know, because these natural orbitals can change their occupation very easily, so you can't make that argument. If you had an LDA type calculation, yes, you can. But if you have this representation, no, you can't.
No, no, the point is that when you don't introduce a few number of holes in my insulator, these holes don't behave like quasi particle at all, because each one of these particle has three energy, two or three energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now you replace them with one energy, and the energy is necessary to be...
I'm not doing that. I mean, I must still do a fully self-consistent calculation or minimization of,
yeah,
of the,
yeah, but in the end of minimization
with these holes there.
Yeah,
I mean,
you can do that.
I don't fix to any k or something.
Right, right.
I mean, it's,
well, actually, you do that. You do the same procedure. You do this epsilon k equal to this energy difference.
Yeah.
That means that every time you measure one quasi-particle of a particular momentum, you get y energy. But the
physical
is
physical. That's physical.
You still
have your doped insulator on the table, and then you make the photo emission experiment. So you add or subtract the particle with momentum k to this doped insulator.
Yes, but except in that case, you get multiple energy in the representation, but you don't get one out of the quasi particle approximation. And that's going to be the damn problem.
But I guess here, because it's a natural orbital has this occupation number, that means that it has more number of bands compared to Kangxian.
Now with this particular formula, the way had evaluated this epsilon k equal to E minus E, ground state, right? That formula does not give you that, that's the point. The theory itself doesn't have a problem, but the way quasi-particle excitation is evaluating that formula, it assumes quasi-particle from the beginning.
So probably one should calculate this by differential instead of difference. Then that means even the natural orbital with the, you know, with the operator smaller than one still can have a...
Well, this is an interesting point. I haven't really thought about this. So let's defer this further to the discussion. We are discussing tomorrow, I think, also doping. And it has, to some extent, a more general nature of this question, to which extent the Lehmann representation and the quasi-particle representation are equivalent and so on. Yeah, okay.
Would you not have a problem with charge in those systems and the... potential offset, I mean the level that you put the Hartree potential to, the electrostatic potential to?
Excellent point, Volker. So how do we actually add or subtract a little bit of charge there? Well, it's a periodic system, so you cannot just add one particle to it or a fractional charge to it. The way it's done is we add charge in each unit cell and compensate by a neutralizing background.
So you have the usual neutralizing background. Mm-hmm.
In fact, one can prove, and we have done this in this paper of last year, that the gap that you get in this way is in fact the same as if you did the finite large system and add really one particle and calculate the gap, make the system bigger. It's not trivial, right? Not obvious statement.
No.
So you calculate for your nk equals a half with compensating backgrounds, and then calculate the derivative.
So this total energy, or this one here, is really one. If you have changed nk away from zero, you have to neutralize it. Okay, final. There's another aspect to the band gap that you may ask, namely whether the gap is between the right states. And this is largely between, for these systems, between EG and T2G. But for nickel oxide, it's known there's a fairly large hybridization with the oxygen P. which gets less and less over this series. And this, many theories, I think LDA plus U has somewhat difficulties describing. And this, even this comes out right with our DNFT calculation. Okay, that's the final plot, and that's the people who did all the work. So that's Nicole Helwig, Nick Tarius, Lathripakis, and Angelia Zacharias for the molecules. And those people, Sangeeta Sharma, Kate Dewhurst, Florian Eich, and Tim Balzriefen, have done the work on solids. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to take a question already.